Welcome to Culture Cryptids, the horror podcast where we dissect culture one undead teenage romance at a time. Hey, JD.
Yes.
What is the most ridiculous and or stupidest thing you've ever done in the name of beauty?
Well, that is a pretty wide open question. I think it has to be back in the late 90s, pre-lumbersexual and pre-everyone being back into body hair for men, kind of. You know, everybody wanted to be smooth like a dolphin. And I decided to nair my chest.
Okay, already.
I didn't even like, you know, I was a teenager at the time, so I didn't even have a whole lot of chest hair to begin with. So I slathered it on and I didn't think about my nipples, and I definitely got chemical burns on my nipples and wasn't able to wear a shirt for like a week.
Oh no.
It was bad.
I'm getting like secondhand like pain. Oh.
It's a smell that I can't stomach anymore either. Like there are things that smell kind of like that.
Yeah.
And it just triggers. It's visceral. Like it's the worst sense memory ever.
You have to, there's a sensitive formula for a reason.
What about you, Corey? What's the most ridiculous thing you've done for beauty?
I mean, there's so many like dumb things, and I feel like the periods of like the late 90s, early 2000s,
they're the worst.
Encapsulate all of them, because I used to do, and I used to think I looked great for some reason, because I've never been like a huge makeup person, but like in that era, I did the whole like clear lip gloss and dark lip liner.
Oh yeah.
That it was so popular. And I was like, this looks great. I look so good. And like, all you would do is just like put that on and like maybe some mascara or something and go out into the universe. And let me tell you, first of all, I should not be allowed to choose any sort of makeup shades for myself left unattended at that age, because oh boy, did I make some decisions.
Yeah, I feel like that whole trend gave everyone what I call MLA, which is mouth like anus.
Oh, I mean, you're not wrong, but that just makes it like even worse to think about that, like, because again, we were basically babies back then, just being like, okay, like I can wear makeup. I'm good. I'm not good at this.
No, we were all doing stupid stuff. Like, here's the thing, though. I would not be shocked if that trend comes back, because if the clothing I saw at Target the other day is any indication, we're like 2.5 seconds away from having like the zigzag parts in our hair.
Oh no.
And butterfly clips. And you remember the hair thing that kind of was like a circle and it was elastic, but it had the teeth?
Yes.
Those are back.
Oh,
I saw
no.
Those at Target the other day.
You know what? If butterfly clips come back, that's fine. You know, everyone has to make poor life choices when they're a teenager. This is just a thing that you have to do. And that's fine. Like, I did it. Let somebody else do it. I'm not going to like, I'm going to judge, because I remember wearing those butterfly clips and then the little like barrettes where you'd piece the barrettes on either side of your like bangs to hold them back.
Oh, I'm very aware. Yeah. And you had the little stringy yep. bits. Yeah.
The only trend that like I really, really, really hope does not come back is just the let's pluck your eyebrows to death trend. Because your eyebrows never recover.
Oh yeah, once they're gone.
Don't do it.
They're gone. Yeah, no, I am.
You will lose them forever.
I feel like I fell victim to that, and thankfully, they did come back. And also, the fact that I had my brows microbladed helped immensely too.
Oh no, so I did the overplucking thing, but I am Eastern European, so that's what we do. We grow hair. Like,
no worry at all.
No worry, it just came right back. It's fine. But for most people, that is a big concern. But at the time, you want to do these things because you want to feel pretty or attractive or masculine, handsome, whatever word you would like to use for the term of beauty.
Yeah.
You want to feel it. And you'll do just about anything to get it.
Yep. So yeah. I think that's a good, that's a great intro for what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. So welcome back to Culture Cryptids. We are here with another episode. And in this week's episode, we really wanted to explore beauty and kind of the subtle art of fucking yourself over to be beautiful, and how some different horror filmmakers have explored that in their works.
And made it a not so art, subtle art.
Right. Not very subtle
not
at
very
all.
Very subtle.
Yeah. But it's true, though, that like we as a society, and even as on like a global scale, are obsessed with self-improvement, and specifically self-improvement that leads to being more attractive. whether that's to the opposite sex, to the same sex, even to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We want to be our most attractive person. And that has led to this like wild rush of just the beauty industry and specifically like beauty brands coming in to kind of take hold on how we look at each other and look at the world.
Well, before we get too deep into it, right. Maybe some introductions are in order.
Sure.
Yes. I'm JD. I'm one of your co-hosts. And my beauty secret, it's dating younger guys and literally sucking the youth right out of them.
I never know how to follow these things when you say them, because I'm like, well, it's your brand and I acknowledge that. But also, God damn it.
Like, I mean, I'm not trying to be like Samantha from Sex and the City and be like, oh, like, oh, catty out. It's just, that's who I am.
You know, that's fine.
Slutty is a slutty does.
And I am the ghost of skincare products abandoned after one use, Corey.
Oh, I am. I need a beverage after that.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking an Alani Nu.
Okay.
This is not SponCon.
No.
But it's my favorite energy drink because they're energy drinks for ladies. They're geared towards them because they're gluten-free.
Okay.
They are vegan.
Okay.
Which I mean, that's necessarily.
I'm trying to figure out what makes these feminine.
But there's biotin, B6, and B12 in them.
All right.
So that you have pretty hair.
Pretty hair. And okay. Nails.
And right. This one is Berry Pop. It is the Addison Rae flavor that just came out recently.
That's that TikToker, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Influencer. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Speaking of influencers, she's
terrible. Sorry.
Influencers are like, influencer culture is a problem. I'm sure some of them are lovely people and I'm sure some of them are not, but she is the one that just launched her own skincare line. Have you heard about this?
Mm-mm.
Okay. It is a brand new one that she launched to protect us from blue light.
Okay. I mean, I understand like blue light, seeing it, it's a problem like later at night.
Yeah. No, it's protecting your skin from your computer screens.
Do what now?
Yeah. So apparently she's gotten some backlash on it. You can buy this stuff at Sephora. Like I have seen it with my own two eyes, but it is basically like the name of it. I can't even remember the name of it, but it's kind of this, like this big mix that's supposed to keep your skin protected from all of the screens you look at all the time so that you won't age. And most people, according to most experts, this is not a problem.
Mm-mm.
Like this, you are coming up with a solution that's not a problem. And the only thing that's in it is like a mixture of like oils, cleansers, and plant extracts.
Does it even have any sunblock in it? Because that's what you should be wearing every day.
I don't think so. I don't think there's any sunblock involved in this. So I don't know what exactly you're blocking from with her brand new product that clearly there's no scientific evidence that makes it work.
No, but, especially if it's a cream.
But people will buy it. And I'm sure people are buying it. They just are like, okay, great. And I mean, sure, if you want to put more oil on your face, do it, I guess. Hopefully it's good oil, but don't think it's going to protect you from your iPhone.
No, but the thing is, people are willing to try everything.
That's true.
Yeah, I have tried some wacky things.
We will do anything to feel pretty, and that's just part of it. Well, like in the U.S. alone, women spend about $313 per month on their appearance.
Wow.
So that's like, yeah, like $300. And that adds up to like, what, $3,700 a year? That's a lot of money. And we're not just talking skincare, but you're talking about hair products. You're talking about makeup. You're talking about gym memberships. You're talking about all these things that people do on average to feel better. And you may be like, well, dudes don't spend that much. You're right. They don't.
Oh, but it's probably not much less.
They spend about $244 per month.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, after the beginning of the new millennium, It was a huge thing. You know, there was like the whole metrosexual culture,
yeah.
And even past that, like again, like the lumbersexual thing,
right?
Like men are encouraged to take care of their facial hair, and skincare is a huge thing for men now too. Much more so than it was whenever we were younger.
And I mean, even if you have like your non-binary and agender people too, are very much like nobody is above this idea of how do I become more attractive to people I want to perceive me as attractive. So skincare is always going to be a big thing. Hair care is always going to be a big thing. And you know, all genders can wear makeup. So any, you know, people buy makeup and yeah, it's a big expense overall.
I mean, I think that like, you know, as we're kind of leading into it, like beauty and like the beauty industry itself is like, I think just intrinsically horrific because you've got like, let's think about some of the things people have done to themselves, like vampire facials.
Okay, so I know what a vampire facial is because I looked it up when you mentioned it before. But explain to someone who has no concept of what a vampire facial is.
So they take, I mean, I think it can vary, but in most cases, you're taking your own blood and getting like the rich plasma out of it and then putting that back on your face to kind of stimulate cell growth. And the thing is, it does work.
It's wild.
Yeah.
But you're putting blood on your face.
You're putting blood on your face.
Your own blood.
I mean, your own blood. But then you also, like, you know, there's the whole thing that you can have done where you put your feet in and, like, the fish eat the dead skin off of your feet. Like, that's horrific. It doesn't hurt, but, like.
You're still letting an animal eat a part out of you. Well, people used to market tapeworms as a dieting thing, and then you would take them out when you were done.
And, like, just plastic surgery in and of itself, like, being sliced and diced and pulled and plucked and everything just to look more beautiful.
Yeah. So there's a lot of this kind of like horrific stuff built into what we could perceive as normal, like every day. Anything from like even like skin bleaching. You're putting these products on your skin to lighten it. You're putting products on your hair to lighten it, like all the time. Like we are doing these things to subtly or not subtly change our bodies. So yeah, there's an element of like body horror in there that is inherent in the things we do to ourselves. But when we look at kind of the, and take a step back from that and like look at the industry as a whole and look at these things that kind of come out of it, there's a whole lot to like that people have said about the nature of beauty.
And I think we picked three good films, I think, to kind of explore this theme, because we've got one that is very much kind of an exploration on the industry as a whole.
Yes.
We have one that's kind of more introspective and like the inner battles we have with ourselves, and then one that's kind of the unrealistic standards that are put on certain people.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're like starting big and then working our way in smaller.
Yeah. I think that's kind of how we have this episode to go. So if you've done your homework, you know, we're starting with this.
Yeah. The homework that we gave, like,
it was ages ago. Yeah.
So you've had plenty of time.
Yes.
You've had plenty of time to catch up.
Totally.
So I think the first one that's a good starting point is 2016's The Neon Demon.
Yes. And that film is, it's about, and according to the IMDb, and we'll kind of try to give you like a quick synopsis, is an aspiring model, Jessie, is new to Los Angeles. However, her beauty and youth, which generate intense fascination and jealousy within the fashion industry, may prove themselves sinister.
Yes, and this was directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, who most people know from having done Drive. That's the big movie, I think, that like really put his name out there for a lot of folks. The story is by him, and then the screenplay is by Mary Laws and Polly Stenham.
So you have this story of this new model who comes to Los Angeles, and she is played by Elle Fanning, who you may know from Super 8, Maleficent, and also playing Catherine the Great in the fabulous, amazing Hulu series, The Great.
It's phenomenal. It's everybody so in that is great, but she really stands out.
Yeah.
And I think that she stands out in this movie.
She really does. Yeah. And she plays Jessie, who is a 16-year-old girl who comes to Hollywood to be a model and is immediately told, you're not 16. You should tell everyone you're 19.
Not 18. Not because 18 is too obvious.
Yes. You have to tell everyone you're 19. And she meets kind of this plethora of characters that come in to her life, including is Carl Glusman, who plays Dean, who is the kind of guy who lives next door to her and wants to date her. And I think he's creepy. Apparently, like, not everyone gets that vibe from him, but I think it's,
No, that's the thing is, like, we're supposed to perceive him, I think, at the beginning as looking out for her and just kind of, like, wholesome all-American. But she's an underage girl.
Yes, and he is aware of that fact. So Jenna Malone is in this film, and I mean, Jenna Malone is amazing at everything, but you may know her from The Hunger Games.
Saved.
Saved. Yeah. The Ruins, another movie we've talked about on the show, and Donnie Darko. I think she made her like first big film appearance was Donnie Darko.
I believe
Darko.
So, yeah.
And she plays Ruby, who is a makeup artist adjacent to this industry, who also works at a morgue. And Jessie meets two other models in L.A., that become close with her. And one is played by Bella Heathcote, who was in Pride and Prejudice with Zombies and the new film Relic and Man in the High Castle. And this, she plays Gigi, which is another model who has had a lot of plastic surgery done, which
kind
of,
she's not a natural beauty.
Yes. She's not a natural beauty, quote unquote. And the other model she meets is Sarah, who's played by Abby Lee, who was in the phenomenal Mad Max Fury Road, as well as Elizabeth Harvest and new the M. Night Shyamalan's Old.
And she's also in Lovecraft Country.
Yes, she is. Yeah, she's great in that. Yeah. She is another model who used to be the quote unquote it girl, much like Jessie is now, but is aging out of that. So these three models all have their struggles, and you kind of see them interact with each other as they first welcome this girl into their ranks, but then watch her, I guess I would use the term bloom, mm-hmm. into something bigger than anyone had anticipated. And how that kind of shakes out is, well, I mean, that's the main part of the story. It's hard to talk about Neon Demon without talking about spoilers. So we are going to discuss the film's ending.
Yeah. But this movie came out in 2016. You've had plenty of time to watch it.
Yeah. We hope that you have watched it, but we also hope that if you haven't, that this will make you watch
but
it.
But the thing is like, even knowing the plot of it and knowing how it ends, it's still a wonderful watch. If for no other reason, just, I mean, it's Nicholas Winding Refn. So it's very visually rich and visually stunning. Right. If nothing else.
If you can't tell, the most of the characters in this film, the really main cast focuses on these four women, but there are a couple other characters that kind of tangentially in here. Keanu Reeves plays a kind of really sleazy hotel owner who is in, kind of has a cameo in it. And then Desmond Harrington plays a well-known photographer. So, but this is a women's, this is a story about women. Mm-hmm. And this is a story about specifically Jessie and her journey through this almost like Alice in Wonderland upside down world of LA.
Yeah. It's a dark fairy tale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. I would definitely phrase it as that. Well, when like Renf, is that how you say his name?
Refn.
Mm-hmm. Commented on like the conception of the project. And he is quoted as saying like, I woke up one morning a couple of years ago and was like, well, I was never born beautiful, but my wife is. And I wondered what it had been like going through life with that reality. He said, I came up with the idea to do a horror film about beauty, not to criticize it or attack it, but because beauty is a very complex subject. Everyone has an opinion about it. And that kind of opinion and all the very different opinions come into this film a lot. And I think it gets a lot of criticism for that because people find it very polarizing in a lot of ways. Some people love it. Some people hate it. And
which I think can be said for most of his movies.
Right, yeah. Right. But I think one of the biggest criticism it always gets is that it's anti-feminism, like anti-feminist. And it focuses on like kind of catty women being catty and these women tearing each other apart.
Which is interesting because, I mean, you know, we've talked about it before and I kind of had to step back from it because, I mean, I am a man. And mm-hmm. in watching this movie, to me, there was lots of it that kind of read as through a male lens. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the screenplay was written by two women. The cinematographer is a woman. Mm-hmm. And when I kind of sat with it a little bit longer, it's not anti-feminist at all.
I agree with you on that. I think the film is very nuanced when it's what mm-hmm. it is saying. It is like it's highlighting the kind of competitive, toxic nature of the industry of beauty and modeling. But that's not the same thing as being anti-feminism because you can critique an industry. And you can critique it as being a problem and kind of fostering these kind of toxic relationships with everybody in it, including both male and female models. Because this is kind of saying that, like, do you think that male models are any less competitive or toxic when it comes to these things?
No, but I would say probably more so since there's less opportunities there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So highlighting the problems in the industry is not the same thing as saying women are catty to each other. And of course they are in this, but the film really takes pains to show that predators specifically come in many shapes and sizes, and that both men and women have the capacity to both do and be evil in this film.
Well, I think that's set up really, I think, really well at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Whenever Jessie first meets the other two girls when they're at that club and they're in the bathroom and the lipstick.
Mm-hmm. Like, yes.
What is the, I can't remember the name of it. Is it Pink Pussy? Is that the name of the lip color?
I think that's the name of it. Yeah. They have a great conversation though, where they ask Jessie in that first meeting, they basically say that lipsticks are named after either food or sex. Mm-hmm. And they turn to her and they're like, well, which one are you?
Yeah.
And that kind of highlights everything about these kind of cutthroat industries in this way, where you put very highly focused and very driven people together and expect them to be competitive and not expect it to become toxic and or this idea of predator and prey, which plays out through this film in multiple ways.
Yeah, because throughout the film, we keep seeing Jessie kind of ascend higher and higher mm-hmm. very quickly in this fashion world. And we've got Sarah and Gigi on the outskirts of that watching very jealously. Mm-hmm. and then everything comes crashing down.
Right, right. And in that, you kind of see the film makes a point to show why they feel this way too. Specifically with Gigi, you have this idea where they're all lined up for a role and it immediately goes to Jesse, but they're having this conversation at the bar about Jesse's beauty being this natural beauty and how innocent and pure and all this idea that's really just tied to her being a virgin in the story, because that's like a plot point in the film, and how that leads to this kind of, you're meant to believe that it may lead to some of her otherworldly beauty, as opposed to Gigi, who's had all this work done, and how she isn't like real. Like they talk about her like she's not a real person anymore.
Yeah, even her, she makes fun of it, like being like more plastic than the person.
Yeah, yeah, which is like really a kind of really horrible way that people look at a woman's body, as both a commodity to be shaped in a certain way, but then when you shape it in this way that is the way it's supposed to look, then, oh, well, you're not real anymore. Mm-hmm. But we still want you to look this way, but we want you not to try to look this way.
Yeah, it's inauthentic.
Yes, yeah, which is the double standard in the industry. And then you have Sarah, who's also off there, is kind of just like, she used to have it, whatever Jesse had. She used to be Jesse, but now whatever it, she's no longer shiny and new. And so she's been cast aside.
And as you said, this otherworldly aspect to it, because mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like hinted at. There is definitely some like witchcraft and like going on here. Mm-hmm. If with nobody else, with Ruby.
Right, right. There is always Ruby to come back to. But that's the thing though, is whatever. And I kind of like this idea. I liken it, as we were talking about, is like a, Jessie's like a flower and you're watching her bloom, mm-hmm. but the kind of fairy, and that ties very well into like fairy tale aspects of you're watching this power within her grow and grow and grow. And she notices it. Everyone around her notices it, but then people start to covet it. And that leads you to kind of this idea of what Ruby wants and what Ruby is actually, because when you first meet Ruby, who Jenna Malone does such an amazing job with her, she's there for Jesse, and she's like, you have to be careful, all these people are predators, you won't get roles unless you sleep with them, that's the only way these, you know, people get ahead, you just need to be really watch yourself and really be careful. She starts this role as, again, another caretaker, and then as time goes, she becomes a predator herself.
Yeah, it, the whole are you food or are you sex, like Ruby, mm-hmm. Ruby perceives Jesse as both.
Yes. Yeah. After all is said and done, both. And I think that she first, like, she first perceives Jesse as sex, and then that kind of turns into food, maybe, mm-hmm. or maybe it's always been both the same time. It's hard to know with Ruby. And I think that makes Ruby a really fascinating villain in this story too.
Well, because there's like, specifically imagery wise, whenever kind of the turning point for Jesse, when I think she really comes into her power, is the fashion show. And there's a lot of imagery with triangles. So we've got like 3 points, and then we have these three women, which, mm-hmm. you know, the whole like a triple goddess thing is present in a lot of folklore and fairy tales. You know, you've got Mother, Maid, and Crone, which each of these women kind of fulfills one of those.
Yeah.
So I love that aspect of it, because mm-hmm. it really drives home the witchery of it all.
Right. So I guess let's talk about the witches, since we're here, let's kind of do it. And because the witches are the driving force behind the story, they introduce kind of Jesse into this world and kind of push her into it. Not push her into it, but like
they're cultivating her. They're tending her like a plant.
Yes, yeah, they are. And then when she reaches a certain point, because it's one of those things where like they are grooming her, much like the industry is grooming her, mm-hmm. and both at the same time. And film is very interesting because it subverts your expectations, because you think, and there's this wonderful, wonderful scene at the beginning where you think that the well-known photographer, like the Desmond Harrington plays, is going to be the one to take advantage of this and to kind of give her this bad experience that's going to send her
like a total casting couch situation. Yes. Yeah.
You go into this thinking this, and she's been warned that this is going to happen. And the suspense in the scene is played out so, I really love the scene because it's so much, so much, so much. And he basically is like, all right, he actually like, it's more of like a worshiping thing. So instead of her being food, she becomes not even sex, but more like a goddess. Like mm-hmm. the way that he
paints her gold.
He paints her gold, I mean, and then kind of
worships. It's not subtle.
Yeah. Worships at the altar with the photography and mm-hmm. like taking this big photo shoot of her. And he is not once like at ever like really inappropriate. And she is just really into it the entire time, like super into it. And you can kind of see there that this already you're like, okay, so she's had this first taste of success. Like what happens now? And of course we find out what happens after that, but they do a really good job of being like, anyone can be a predator, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is. And at least this character is not portrayed as a predator in the film.
Yeah. And then there's the, you know, the whole classic, like pride cometh before the fall thing.
Yes.
Cause you know, we had a discussion about it where I kind of had this perception that she was unaware of her power and that she's coming into it. And then, you know, before the climax of the movie, she finally realized it. But it's not that. Like, she's known it all along. She's just ready to be open about it.
She has that line that she says to them early in the film when the girls are talking, where she's basically like, yeah, I knew I was pretty and I can make money off pretty. So she knows what she is. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know exactly how much power she has, but she knows she has power and has had it.
And she just gets brazen about it at the end. Yes. Yeah.
So then she ends up in this situation where she is maybe, we don't know what goes on in the hotel room because there's a lot of weird scenes of like how much of this is real, how much of this is imagined. Because there's a scene with a mountain lion, which again is giving us that more not quite subtle like precursors to predator prey, where there is a predator in her room. There is this idea that the hotel owner is sexually assaulting the 13-year-old girl that's in the room next to hers. And then she runs from that to Ruby, who also tries to take advantage of her and does not take no for an answer and initiates sort of like a sexual assault. Like she tries. And then it comes to this final confrontation with these three girls where Jesse stands there and is like, no, fuck you, I'm the prettiest, is kind of where it goes.
Yeah. Like in that, the whole part, the climax at the, you know, the empty pool, which, mm-hmm. I mean, the first time you see this pool empty, you're like, something's going to happen here.
Yeah.
But she has the whole line, like, you know what? My mother used to call me dangerous. You're a dangerous girl. She was right. I am dangerous. And then the other one was like, I know what I look like and what's wrong with that anyway. Women would kill to look like this. They carve and stuff and inject themselves. They starve to death, hoping, praying that one day they'll look like a second-rate version of me.
Right. And then that is sort of a very easy thing for, I think, a lot of, not just models, not just people in the beauty industry, but also if we look at it in the modern context, beauty influencers and TikTokers and Instagram models and all these things, that people who are like, I'm at the top of my game, nothing can go wrong for me, everything is perfect. And you have that moment where you're standing, you are standing on the diving board of an empty swimming pool and you don't even know that it's empty. And then of course you fall in. And that's exactly what happens, where you have this plummet where you are then consumed by the very thing that created you.
Literally consumed.
Literally consumed in the case of these three witches who, you know, they push her upwards and then push her back down, literally to just chew her up and spit the parts of her out.
Yeah, they've tended her. She's bearing fruit and now mm-hmm. they're going to harvest her.
Right.
Literally.
Literally. And that's what the industry does to a lot of young women. And you've seen it since the 90s and the rise and fall of the supermodels. There's a great docuseries on Hulu called like The Dark Side of the 90s, which has a whole episode on the supermodel phenomena of the 90s. And I hadn't watched it until recently. And I was thinking all about Neon Demon while I'm watching that episode. And I was like, yeah, this is what the industry is. And I think they're able to tell this story because they have so many people in the cast that have worked in the industry for so long.
Yeah. I mean, because Abby Lee was... Christina Hendricks, who's in the movie as well, is also a model. Mm-hmm. Jamie Clayton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the cast is littered with actual people who have experience in this world.
Right. So it does feel very like authentic. And the director has also been pretty overt in that he was kind of inspired by the story of Elizabeth Bathory. So you have this coven of witches, I think we could call them, who devour the power of a young woman to give themselves health and vitality. And then that's very tied to the false stories about Elizabeth Bathory's cannibalism, vampirism, and, you know, all those occult behaviors where she bathed in the blood of virgins. And you do, in fact, see Ruby standing mostly naked with a hose, hosing the blood off of herself. So it's very overt.
Yeah. And And it does have a really, like, I think almost a classic fairy tale ending too, because we have Gigi and Sarah who have consumed her to Jesse to take her power, and then they go on a shoot, and it doesn't end well for Gigi.
Yeah. There's this idea that not everyone can handle that level of like power, and Gigi does not handle it.
You can't stomach it. Literally. Yes,
she can't stomach the industry. Yeah. She's done all of this to herself, and then she's taken this step that is just one step too far, and she literally can't stomach it and can't stomach herself. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Sarah picks up the pieces and is like, okay, I got this. And that leads us to the infamous eyeball scene.
Yeah.
Which you can't, first time I watched this movie, I have to tell the story. I watched it with a really good friend of mine, and she doesn't do eye gore at all. So normally when we know it's coming, a lot of times if we know it's coming, we can like avoid it and like close your eyes. And I'll tell you when to open them again and you'll be fine. But this happens, and Gigi and her isn't able, like they're waiting on this shoot, and Gigi just isn't able to take it anymore. And then vomits up this whole horrific blood and kind of like pieces of Jesse. And one of them is her eyeball. And we saw that and we're like, oh no, that's not going to end well. But then as Gigi is literally tearing herself apart, Sarah walks over and just picks up the eyeball and just pops it into her mouth like a grape. And my poor friend made the most horrible noise, bless her so much. And then she leapt out of her chair and like had to go hide because it was downstairs, like on the stairs, and wait until the scene was over. And I was like, I felt so bad, but it was also like, yeah, that was intense. Like, I feel like if you have an issue with it,
oh, it's visceral.
It's super visceral. And like, it was a very well done director, sir, to get that much of a reaction out of somebody.
And to be that, like, have that be just the period, like on the end of the sentence that is this movie. Like, it's a great ending part to it. I think another thing I read that just kind of, I think, encapsulates the movie very well is that Elle Fanning in the movie's commentary, in the very opening shot that we see, which is, I think, wonderfully done, where she's in a photo shoot where she looks like she's been killed, which is like great foreshadowing. She said that she had to keep her eyes open for so long in that opening shot that her contact lenses burned onto her eyes.
Oh my God.
Of the hot lights.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The price of beauty right there. Like, even in a film, pointing it out. So yeah, I think this ending is just really, really well done. And I know a lot of people say that this film is all style with no substance in it. And I do think if you're looking for a flashy horror film that has a bunch of kill counts, this isn't really going to be one that you want to watch. But if you are more interested in kind of this slow psychological descent into a dark fairy tale, in with a lot of symbolism that isn't particularly subtle in a lot of ways, this is definitely it for you. Like, you should watch this film, because again, it's all about this idea of the consumption of your innocence, even in yourself, which leads to this idea of like your arrogance and your confidence that can either boost you up, or like Ruby, she is able to consume the life force of other women. And
because this is obviously not the first time she's done this.
No.
She's planted a lot of rose bushes.
She has planted a lot of rose bushes. So you have her as a person who is able to like shape beauty and become the system. And the same thing happens with Sarah, that she is able to become the system. And then you have those who are consumed by it and destroyed.
This movie, I think, again, good starting point, because it's kind of a really kind of macro view of it, like looking at, at the industry as a whole and how that impacts people. And I mean, Jesse is not our only victim in this movie, you know, obviously, like we've got Gigi, but like literally everybody is a victim to some degree in this film. So I think we can go ahead and kind of focus a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take kind of this idea of beauty and what it means to make someone else beautiful and how that reflects upon you, and talk about probably one of my favorite films that I watched last year, which was The Stylist, which actually came out in 2020.
This is one of those movies. I love it. It's great. Mm-hmm. I never want to watch this movie ever again.
This was, I think, really painful for you to watch.
Yeah.
You really struggled with it in a good way. Yeah. And I think because you see those movies and you're like, this is, oh no, oh no. There's this like dread, this low level dread that follows you through. And The Stylist is a film that just wins at that so well. So let's talk about it. Tell me a little bit about the stylist.
So from our trusted source, IMDb, a lonely hairstylist becomes obsessed with the lives of her clients and descends into murderous madness.
Right. And it was written and directed by Jill Javarjasian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who also goes by the title of Jill Six. And she's known for directing a number of shorts, one of which is the original version of The Stylist, which you can actually watch on YouTube. You can watch that original version, but I would highly recommend just holding out, watching the full film.
Because the short is kind of a prequel almost. Like it takes place before the
yes,
movie, right?
Yes, it takes place before the film. And she has a production company called Six Tape. So this is her first full-length production. But she's also done a bunch of producing of a bunch of other shorts and specifically like a lot of horror stuff. So the cast is really only two people in this film that are... I mean, there's a lot of other people in it, but there's really only two big ones. One is Najara Townsend, who is also in this wonderful film called Contracted.
Yes.
Which is a zombie flick where she plays the main lead in that. And she plays Claire, who is our hairstylist, who is an introverted, kind of introspective young woman who is very kind of stuck in this routine of, I go to work, I'm very good at my job, but does not know how to connect to other people. So the story of this film is her slowly descending into this state of, I mean, into serial killer territory. And the film isn't shy about this. Like, it tells you what you're in for. And as this is happening, she meets another young woman named Olivia, who is played by Bria Grant, who's better known for her directing work. And I don't know, have you seen Lucky that came out in 2020 as well?
I haven't. What I know her from, the only thing I really know her from is Beyond the Gates.
Oh, okay. Yes, yeah. She's in Beyond the Gates. Lucky is fantastic too, if you want a film that talks about like female trauma and just like this idea of day-to-day like trauma is really good. And she's also in 12 Hours. She also directed 12 Hour Shift, which is another film about a woman working a 12-hour shift in an abandoned hospital, which is really good. Both really psychological films. And this is one of her only like big acting credits, and she does a great job. She plays Olivia, who befriends Claire because Olivia needs someone to do her hair for her wedding.
Yeah, and Olivia's been a client of Claire's for some time.
Yes.
And she asks to have Claire do her hair for the wedding, which Claire is very reluctant to do. Yes. So she's like, I don't do wedding hair. And then she finally gives in.
Mm-hmm.
This movie, I think, just like The Neon Demon, it relies really heavily on its visuals and its music.
Yeah.
We've talked about it before. You like to make fun of me for it. Like, music is such a huge thing for me. And the scoring in this movie is fantastic.
You were very excited about the music. And as someone who is not musically inclined at all, I can say that it was very effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would use the term effective for it without being able to really describe why I felt that way. But yeah, it was really good.
Just to kind of give a synopsis, and this is one that I don't want to give too much away for, just because it is a newer film.
Right. Yeah, this is a new film. So we'll tell you a little bit about the story, but this is one of those you really need to kind of watch yourself
and process on your own.
Yeah.
And then maybe never want to watch again. It's good, but like, it's uncomfortable.
I will watch it again, but you are not the only person that we watched it with, because we watched this film together. Mm-hmm. Who had the same reaction of like, I don't need to see that again. Very good. Don't need to see it again.
Yeah. I mean, we open with Claire, you know, doing hair for someone. And then again, as you said, we know very from the beginning that she has murderous tendencies.
Yes.
She's reluctant to help Olivia out with the situation, and then she gives in. And throughout the rest of the movie, we kind of see why she didn't want to do this in the first place.
Right. She spends her entire life making other people beautiful, and other people come in, tell her all about their lives. They tell her all these little dirty little secrets that no one should really tell anybody, but you feel safe talking to the service industry person who's doing this for you. You know, this is pretty standard, I think, with all hairdressers or hairstylists.
Oh, I mean, we have friends who are hairstylists. Yes. And they will be the first to tell you that they are essentially, yes, they're providing a service to make you look beautiful, but they're also like therapists to
yeah.
a certain degree.
Yeah. So she's in this kind of idea where all these people will tell her all of these things, and yet none of them really seem to want to connect with her. And as a person who desperately wants to connect with other people, Claire is very bad at seeing the difference between a friendship and this sort of casual transactional relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes up again and again because she remembers things about these people. She knows their lives. She knows their things. And they just sort of feel like they're coming in to get a service done. And I really think that that's a really fascinating way of looking at like some of this, like her as a character, is to kind of view her as that, because no one asks her how she's doing. No one asks her about her life, or no one seems to care. And that's all she wants desperately, is for someone to care.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that kind of what unleashes, you know, kind of the havoc that happens in this movie is that you can see that Olivia is just being nice.
Yes.
You know, she's trying to include Claire in this thing just to be a nice person. And Claire perceives it as so much more, and it just keeps building and building.
And there's the thing though, is like, I kind of wonder though, is like, do you invite your hairstylist to your bachelorette party?
Well, I mean, I am friends with my hairstylist.
Yeah, so you are. And like, I am too, yeah, friends with my hairstylist. But
are we really? We are. I mean, literally, we are.
I hope we are. I'll have to ask her next time to be sure. But that's the thing. There's like, I think a lot of people view this as not a friendship. It's sort of like someone you go to and it's your hair person, mm-hmm, and you talk to them, but are you really friends? Do you hang out outside of it? And like, of course we do. Like, we hang out with our hairstylist outside of when they see us, but that's not normal, I think, for a lot of people. And that's fine. Like, I'm not saying everyone, you should befriend everyone that you meet, but Claire is really bad at boundaries. And you see it again with the barista who knows her coffee order, because she also reads into that this person is showing some interest in her. And what does that say for like a friendship? Because right, that's all she desperately wants. And you look at Claire, she seems to have everything.
That's the thing, is like, she's a fascinating character, mm-hmm, because she is objectively attractive.
Yes.
She has great style. Mm-hmm. She has obviously a job that pays her well, because her house, yeah, is, she has a very large house.
Yeah.
But she just, there's something that she's not getting, mm-hmm, and she'll do anything.
And
yeah.
And like, I feel personally watching the film, the thing she's not getting is feeling needed. Mm-hmm. Like, she wants to feel needed. And the crux of feeling needed is this idea of making friendships as an adult is hard once you are out of school, once you are on your own in any sort of context, where it can be difficult when you don't know where to go to find a friendship.
Yeah. And I think that that's maybe why myself and other people are made uncomfortable by this movie, is mm-hmm, that there's a lot of the character of Claire that when you strip it down is, yeah, it's extremely relatable.
Yeah.
And it makes you uncomfortable because it makes you explore some things about yourself.
And I also think that a lot of people who reviewed this film, especially like a lot of male reviewers too, mm-hmm, which I thought was really interesting, called it like lackluster. And they were basically like, well, none of the reviewers seemed to kind of catch on to this idea of like this obsessive nature of friendships. And that can come down to the fact that like most men are on their own are not very good at fostering friendships without another connective thread.
Right.
Like, and this is not me shit talking dudes or anything like that. This is like, studies have shown that,
I mean, you're allowed to shit talk dudes.
Well, so. Yeah, but it is harder for men to find male friendships in a lot of ways, unless there's some sort of like, unless you're like sports fans together, buddies that you go do with, most of their fulfilling kind of relationships come from a romantic relationship, mm-hmm, as opposed to women who like usually have both a romantic relationship, but find fulfillment with their friendships as well, more outside of the home. So I think that might be one of the reasons that it maybe doesn't resonate as much with that audience or that reviewer.
It's interesting that you say that, because I hadn't thought about that before as far as like, you know, the male friendship perspective versus female. Mm-hmm. And I think like, you know, thinking about it as far as myself as a queer man, mm-hmm, it, you know, you're like, men, it's romantic relationships are kind of like the basis for a lot of their things. And then women are more socially friendship. But I think like, there's a really awful intersection of that as a queer man.
Yeah, probably. Actually, that's definitely true. And I don't mean to say that like men can't maintain friendships or men can't do any of these things. This is not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that men are really Claire. This is not the thesis statement here. But it is, I think, that when you have been this person who has been lonely and trying to see what other people have and want that relationship for yourself, which is where I think that our connection to beauty elements come in, is that she's so envious of what she sees in these other women, and she wants it so badly that she sees the only way to get it is to emulate them down to a very specific physical component.
Which, hair is important.
Hair is very important.
It's a great thing to use, because we are like, our hair is so important to us. It's, mm-hmm, important to everyone.
Yeah.
So I think that was great that they use that. Another thing that I really liked about this film that they use is the use of text messaging in it.
Oh, yeah.
And showing that on the screen, because that is very fucking relatable to like the typing something out, especially like when you're trying to foster like a new friendship with someone or a new relationship, typing something out and then deleting it and then typing something out and then deleting it. Yeah.
Yeah. This is all like really good about this kind of like the idea of our obsession with other people's lives and our obsession with what they have and their perceived attractiveness. Because with Claire, again, like these, all these connections she's trying to make with her, making her text messages are all trying to make her seem more relatable, more like even in a friendship level, attractive to this new potential friend for hers.
So what do you think it is about the situation with Olivia specifically that makes Claire crack and become really sloppy?
I think for the first time she feels needed, that Olivia needs her. Olivia calls her in a panic sometimes. Olivia confides things to her about her relationship that Olivia should not be confiding to a stylist. So when you say that like Olivia is just being nice, I don't know. I think Olivia is either was looking for a friendship and then backed out of it when she realized that Claire was too intense, or really just doesn't understand social cues either. Because you don't tell somebody those things and not like expect some sort of like bonds to be formed.
Right.
When you tell someone a secret, that creates like a relationship between you and that person, whatever that secret is and whatever they do with it. So Claire perceived that as, this is my friend. This is my best friend, is sort of what it became. And I mean, like, yeah, she invites her out to her bachelorette party. They go out and like things seem to be going well. They have wine night with one another. These are all things that you do with new friends. And I think that she starts to unravel further and get sloppy, as you would say, because throughout the film, she's still doing her thing. Like she's still having a bad day and doing her thing. But I think she gets sloppy because this was more real. This relationship with Olivia. So she has to go out, and if she isn't good enough to be in a, and I say relationship with Olivia, because that's what it feels like, then maybe she could be someone else who is.
Yeah. It's just kind of a whole situation of like blood in the water. Like there's actually a little bit of, like she gets a little bit of a taste and it sends her into a frenzy because it might be real.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's part of it too, because everything, again, the idea is, it's not a spoiler to say that it's on the cover of this film, that when Claire sort of feels this way, her MO is to take basically the scalp of a person and wear it herself and kind of try to become that person through mannerisms and through their affectation and speech and the things that they like and the people that they are.
It's beyond just being a trophy for her. Like it would be for like most serial killers, it becomes like a mask that she can put on and become that person and feel, you know, and kind of let go of all of the burden and weight of being the uncomfortable person that she is.
Yeah. And I think that's like really telling about the things that we do as people to kind of mask our worst traits and think that if we can just fix something in our outward appearance, that all the inner shit goes away. And it doesn't.
No.
We know it doesn't. We know it doesn't work. But like Claire, you really just want to hide it as long as possible and until you can't anymore.
Yeah. And this, I love the ending of this film, because there's that little bit of respite where you're like, okay, things might be okay. And then much like Neon Demon, the final scene in this movie just really, it packs a punch.
You are waiting for things to implode. And I think like any good horror movie, you're always waiting for that. But this film really builds that whole sense of dread and the whole build up. And you don't know how things are going to implode because so many things could go wrong for Claire and for Olivia in the little ending. And I think the film does it well. I don't think it needs to do more than it does. And I think that's where people kind of assume when you see a slasher that you're going to get a certain kind of content. And when you don't get it here, well, you don't get it here. But when you look at the films that this film was like inspired by, and like the director, Jill Six, has been very, very clear on like her inspiration, was like one of them was Lucky McKee's May, which is a great underrated film.
Yep.
Black Swan, which you can see Black Swan's imprint all over this.
Oh, yeah.
And then also Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like the original one. And yeah, you can see that too, where it's almost less is more in a lot of cases. So yeah, I think that this film does a really good job kind of focusing on our inner kind of sense of worth and how others perceive us, how it makes us feel.
So we've looked at large as a whole. We've looked introspectively. I think we have one more film to discuss that is kind of a really good thing to kind of tie the two parts together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's 2020's Bad Hair,
which is another criminally underrated film that I wish had. I don't understand why this film did not get a theater release. And I know
this and The Stylist, they're both pandemic films.
They're pandemic films, but this is on Hulu. Watch this movie. Like, I have to tell you, like, so.
Can we talk about how, like, Hulu does a really good job of putting out some good horror content?
They really do. Yeah. They really do. Non-sponsored. This is non-sponsored, but.
But if they wanted to.
Yeah. So Bad Hair is, and this one I think is like a really, the IMDb description for this one really does a good job of summing it up. It's set in 1989, an ambitious young woman gets a weave in order to succeed in the image-obsessed world of music television. However, her flourishing career may come at a great cost when she realizes that her new hair may have a mind of its own.
And this was written and directed by Justin Simien.
Yes.
Who did Dear White People, both the film and the Netflix series. And is also working on the upcoming Star Wars Lando Calrissian series.
Yes. He is. I'm very excited to see that one. And he's also doing the upcoming Haunted Mansion film.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited about that. Like, very cautiously optimistic excited. Like, let's put it that way. I want it to be good so bad.
And anyone, like, I think it's safe in his hands.
Yes. Yeah. Same with Lando. Like, yeah. I feel like we're going to get a really fun product out of both of these things. And I'm glad he's making that Disney money. You make that Disney money.
Get that coin.
Do it. So this is kind of, this film feels like very much in the same vein of Dear White People, and that it's a satirical film. But instead of like a satirical, like college comedy, he's got this like satirical horror film. And oh man, this is a good one. And this film is just really a who's who of like entertainment from the 90s too.
There are so many people. I mean, like, so our cast, we have Elle Lorraine playing our main character, Anna Bledsoe, who has been Insecure and also Dear White People.
Yes.
And then we have the character of Zora, who's played by Vanessa Williams.
Right. So Vanessa Williams, who you may know as Miss America 1984. No one will take that from her. That is what she is. Thank you very much.
Also Ugly Betty, where she plays a very similar type character.
Yeah. And also recording artist Vanessa Williams plays a former supermodel who takes over as the EVP of this music television station, which has historically done Black music. Like, that is their focus, is Black music. You have James Vanderbeek coming in here, old Dawson's Creek himself, Varsity Blues, and of course, most important work that he's ever done is Don't Tell the Bee in Apartment 23.
Oh, Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23.
Don't Trust the Bee, yes.
Oh my God. That's the thing, is like, he is so good at playing these douchebag characters.
Yes. So you know what you're getting with him too. He's playing Grant Madison, who is the new station owner who's coming in to revamp and revitalize this station. And poor Anna, who is our main character, is kind of this really talented woman who doesn't know how to get ahead. And she thought she maybe had this place, but now everything's new coming in and changing. But
because she's been trying to do it the quote unquote right way. She's been trying to show the merit of her work and, you know, work hard and everything. And
she's
not
paying her dues.
Yeah, exactly.
But she is so good, and no one is like acknowledging how good she is at this.
Also, I have to mention that Kelly Rowland. One of Destiny's Children is also in this movie.
Kelly Rowland plays Sandra, which is a pop star, and is kind of the focus point where this whole kind of weeb obsession comes from our main character, because she has a new music video out, and in it, she has this new weave, and it's beautiful and fantastic. And
she's positioned as kind of a very like a Janet Jackson type character.
Yes. Yeah. And you also have Jay Farrow from SNL and Unsane, which is another fantastic film,
which we've talked about.
Yes. Who plays Julius, is a VJ and kind of like this this guy who's been, he wants to get ahead so badly, and he's kind of been stringing Anna along. Like, they sleep together, but he won't acknowledge it. And like, she's a side piece for him, which is very, very like heartbreaking for her. There is Lena Waithe, who you may know from Ready Player One, Master of None. She's in Onward, and she's got a ton of producing credits. Mm-hmm. She plays Brooklyn, who's one of the employees at the station who is trying to work within the new standards. Like, she's like, okay, you guys want me to be more quote unquote palpable for our new audience.
She's an existing VJ, yes. And she's trying to mold, like, she's trying to do whatever it takes to stay, yes, you know, to stay relevant,
in the station. Yeah. And then you have Yanni King, who is in Saving Grace. And she's another VJ called Sister Soul, who is kind of pushing back against these standards just a little bit. And then you have Laverne Cox, who Orange is the New Black, Promising Young Woman, the Rocky Horror Picture Show remake that they did, that as Virgie. And she is the hairstylist who is the hairstylist in the city.
Yeah, she's the one who's giving all these wonderful weaves to
yes,
people.
Yes, yes. And then you also have Usher, who shows up as Sandra's assistant. And I'm like, oh, it's Usher. I haven't seen you in a movie in so long. Like, we've gone back and been watching a lot of these like late 90s, early 2000s movie. And I'm like, Usher is in this movie. Like, Usher is in every movie. Okay. So it's really fun to see this kind of like list of who's from this like 90s and even like, you know, 90s era playing these roles. And this is totally a period piece. Like, there's no way around it. This is a love letter to the 80s, and also I don't want to call it like a hate letter, but just sort of like a conversation about what it was like to work in the industry as a Black person in the 80s and 90s.
That turn from the 80s to the 90s, like, mm-hmm. Justin Simien does a great job, mm-hmm. kind of showing how that transition between the two, how that worked.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the focus on style and becoming, again, I said more palpable, quote unquote, to a quote unquote larger audience, which really just means white
audience.
Let's be honest. Yeah. And how people were kind of like, you could kind of go in one or two directions at the time, where you had what you would do in terms of style and that sort of thing. And as Simien said himself, he was like, this is my way of writing a love letter about all of the BS that Black women have to go through. Like, this is what he's doing with this film. And it works. It super works. It's a really fun movie. And he was also inspired by the haunted, possessed hair horror films from like East Asia, like Korea. Mm-hmm. There's a Korean film called The Wig. And he was like, I just really want to make a haunted hair story. But of course you have to make it like culturally relevant and to American audiences. So he really rooted it very firmly in the Black experience with hair.
Yeah. But like, you can tell that from some of the visuals of the haunted hair, yes, in this movie. It reads like a lot of like the visually stuff that you see in those Asian movies. I think it's funny that we picked this one, because much like, you know, Neon Demon is a dark fairy tale, mm-hmm. folklore plays such a huge part in this movie.
It does.
Too.
It does. And you see a lot of that. And like, yeah, with beauty and folklore and fairy tales kind, mm-hmm. of really tie very much in together. And what he's doing with this is a whole lot of that, of being like, yeah, let's talk about beauty as it relates now and how these standards work. But let's tell it as a fairy tale story, because that's the thing though. It's like, and a lot of people call this movie camp, and I'm like, this movie isn't, I don't know. I don't know if I would call it camp, but it is, it's a horror satire. So yes, it's got comedy in it, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of satire elements, and there is a little bit of camp with some of the hair shenanigans, I will say, that go on. And
I think the third act, you see a lot of that, but I think that he does that. He does a good job of using the comedy and the camp elements there in the third act to kind of diffuse what otherwise might be.
It would be too much.
Yeah.
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 And it is an homage to those East Asian hair horror movies. But it is it's a solid message about kind of beauty and the price that we will pay for it. Because as the film gets started, we see poor Anna trying to fit into this new, it was called culture. And now I keep trying to call it a website, but there was no websites in the 80s. It would be a website now. Yeah. Like, that's what it would be. But trying to fit into this music television station that used to be called Culture and now is called Cult. And if that isn't like
I mean,
so telling from right there. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and then the look of it too, like the look, it becomes extremely sanitized, even like the offices, like the offices are redone and they're very much like almost in what I like to call like the late 90s Taco Bell aesthetic.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Know, like solo jazz.
Oh,
like.
It is. Oh my God. It's so true. Yeah. And they kind of take all the personality and everything that made culture kind of, and you see this kind of trickling down, like made culture this phenomenon in the first place. And they're trying to pull it out and make it again, that white television standards to take away what makes the station a station. And it does a really good job by pointing out what, you know, that Black people face a lot of issues in corporate America. They have to conform to white beauty standards because the code for professional is the code basically for looking as white as possible in a lot of ways. Cause that does, it negates like natural hairstyles for Black men and women. And so many natural Black hairstyles are considered unprofessional and messy just for existing. So this film kind of tackles that in that era of when Black culture, and I'm going to say this, like, I'm not an expert in this era. I have read a lot of pieces. I'm going to link some of them that I've read that I think have said this much better than me, including an article by Shantae Griffin called How Natural Black Hair at Work Became a Civil Rights Issue, which is a fantastic article. We'll link it in the show notes. You should read it. It outlines some of this kind of cultural changes that happened in this era too. But like the natural hair movement was so big in like the 60s and 70s, especially with like as Black people were fighting against racial discrimination in the civil rights front, but also for their hair choices. Like hair was a big part of the civil rights movement. And then in the 80s, 90s, people started to move back to altering hair to that like pressed and permed look and braids more often. So I think that setting this in the 80s is like a perfect storm of this, why your hair matters, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's still extremely relevant today, sadly enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing that like this film does a really good job taking this, and as he calls it, it's a love letter to these BS beauty standards. That it's a love letter to like what Black women have to do to themselves to be quote unquote professional.
Yeah.
And I really like this movie. I think that there's so much fun stuff in it, like with the pain of going through what you will do to be pretty, well, or quote unquote pretty.
Yeah, it's a good exploration of that because, you know, when we find out like about the hair, like what it, you know, the cost of having the hair itself.
Yeah.
At first, Anna is horrified by it, but then she kind of relents and gives in a little bit.
Yeah.
To it.
Yeah. And that's the whole thing is like, I'm never going to pay this much money for hair. And then it's like, okay, but I can do it. Like I can make this work. I can get this money and make it done. And then I'll do it. And then it's like, well, it hurts too bad. I don't want to have it done. And then it's like, no, I'll do it just to get ahead because it's what she has to do. And then the immediate difference when she gets the weave and how people treat her. Like, yeah, it's just like a turn face of like, oh, who are you? You must be new here.
I've been here for years.
Yeah.
You're just now noticing me.
Just now noticing me because of these like small, like nonsensical changes that I have made to my appearance. And I like that they kind of pointed out that like when the general public perceives you as beautiful, more opportunities start to come for you. And that's really telling too.
Yeah. And not to give too much away, but you know, at the end of the movie, we're kind of left with the little bit of information that all of this horrific stuff that's happened and this haunted hair that's out there is because of a white man.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Of course. Of course. It's the story itself. Like the folklore elements is of course this kind of haunted hair that goes with this story because her uncle, Anna's uncle is a professor who studies folklore specifically. And he shares with her the story of like the moss haired girl, which is a folklore story that was created for this film, but is really kind of a fascinating look at generational trauma. We'll talk about generational trauma again. Cause, that's a thing that comes up in this film in terms of like the, and it's lore that supposedly came from like Black slave women. And how it relates to the overall story. And again, I don't want to give anything away because I really want you to watch this film and for all of these elements, but gosh, there's that scene at the end and with the attack of the hair, and it's just, it is, he does a really good job weaving this.
No.
Weaving. Yeah. Oh, I said that. Yeah.
The amount of times that, like, weaving and the amount of times we've said ahead.
Ahead. In this one. Oh, yeah. But these, like, the way he tells the story, the way that, like, Justin Simien tells the story is just that perfect spark of, like, this is really funny, but also my point is really relevant at the same time. He's just a really good filmmaker for that.
Yeah, because it's like, you're laughing because it's ridiculous, and mm-hmm. it's like, oh, no. It is ridiculous, funny, but it's also ridiculous.
Yes.
Because we're still at a point where there are not enough protections in place mm-hmm. for people to have natural hair.
Yes.
In a professional environment. I mean, we've got the Crown Act in California, mm-hmm. but that's one of the few where there are protections, correct?
I believe so. I think the Crown Act was the first. Can you explain the Crown Act for those who may not know it?
Yeah, it's an acronym for Create a Respectful and Open Workplace for Natural Hair. And it's mm-hmm. essentially, it's a protection employment-wise saying, having natural hair does not mean that you're not being professional. And having natural hair, you can't use that as a basis not to give someone a job or give them a promotion. It's protected just like, you know, age discrimination, race, things of that nature.
Right. And I think a few other states have begun mm-hmm. to pass their own laws against, to make like race-based hair discrimination illegal. And that's been a slow process though, because not every state has one, and they should. America, don't be a dinosaur. Like, you know, like, come on guys. It really comes down to it. But I think pointing out this standard by using the 80s while still saying, no, this still exists mm-hmm. now. This is still incredibly relevant to talk about even now, while doing it in this way that allows the audience to kind of be like, yeah, that is kind of ridiculous that you have to go through all that to keep your job and to be successful. It's a really good way to like introduce audiences to this concept.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it makes it giving the distance mm-hmm. time-wise on it, it makes it a little bit more easy to swallow, even though it's still extremely relevant.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also like, this is a funny, funny movie.
Oh yeah. It's great. It's great. Everyone should watch it. Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. Going back to the folklore in this and the folklore in Neon mm-hmm. Demon, like, I think it's funny, like talking about how the whole concept of the price of beauty, how it's explored a lot in horror. It's such a huge thing in fairy tales that have been with us forever too.
So true. Yeah. So true. So much time beauty and morality are so tied together in folklore that it's so hard to kind of pick them apart. And as we've seen in like a couple of the films that we talked about now, it means that like you pay for your beauty in a lot of fairy tales in some form or fashion. And it's this idea of a woman, idea of a villain who wants your beauty. And most of the time it's either a woman who wants to own your beauty or a man who wants to possess you for it mm-hmm. are kind of the two villains that we see in a lot of folk tales. But there's this idea that either a woman has beauty and must be protected for her beauty, or a woman wants beauty and will do anything to get it.
Well, yeah, because it's beauty, being beautiful mm-hmm. means that you're a good person.
Right. And a lot of times, like, that dates back to the ancient Greeks mm-hmm. where beauty is seen as a divine gift. You are gifted from the gods with beauty. And if you are beautiful, then, oh, that must mean that the gods like you. So if you are loved, then you are good, which is why we call attractive people good today.
Looking. Yeah.
It's wild, right? Like the way that these kind of connect. And we attribute a lot of morality to attractive people. We trust attractive people more. We will believe what they say. We will allow them kind of like to be in positions of power a lot more often because they're seen as good, just because they are good looking. And yeah, beauty acts as a motivator. It is a motivator in so many fairy tales and so many stories. And in these movies, we see beauty as the primary like motivating factor for the story.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, tracing it all the way back, like, you know, like you said, to ancient Greece, as far as beauty being a gift and mm-hmm. meaning that you were beloved by the gods. I think it just really like nails it and pounds it home that we understand that, like, you know, beauty does have a price. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is it's, we're willing to pay it.
We are.
Everybody's willing to pay it to a certain degree, whether it is harming ourselves mm-hmm. or harming other people. Mm-hmm. We're open to doing it.
Yeah. And what is kind of, we walk this fine line of like, to get what we want versus like, how much harm does it do in the long term? And everyone falls at a different spot in that line.
Yeah, we struggle to be beautiful, mm-hmm. and we will kick and claw and do whatever we have to,
right?
to achieve that. And those standards change so quickly.
They do. They really do. It's hard to keep up with what's popular now versus what was popular 5 years ago in fashion and beauty and hair and even skincare. Like, everything changes constantly. So to keep up, you really have to spend a lot of money or a lot of time.
Or both.
Or both. Or you use Instagram filters.
Well, I think that the Instagram filter thing, I think, is an interesting thing to bring up, because now you have people going to plastic surgeons and cosmetic surgery and showing a picture of them with a filter being like, make me look like this.
Yes. This is what I want to look like. And then you have, like, speaking of racial beauty standards, you have the rising popularity of the Brazilian butt lift, mm-hmm. where a lot of people are trying to achieve a body shape that is completely unrealistic for them, but they'll go and do these surgeries, which are very risky surgeries. Like, again, and even with the best plastic surgeon, like, this is something that you take fat out of one part of your body and put it in another part, and there's really you don't have any guarantee it's going to work. And yeah, you could look great afterwards, but like, what are you trying to emulate with those style surgeries too? Like, that's kind of an interesting concept that we probably don't have time to go into now, but yeah, we'll do anything to stay beautiful just a little bit longer.
Yeah. And I think that definitely this topic is something that we will probably revisit, because sadly there is so much media out there that explores it.
There are,
in
yes.
different ways. Cause like, I think we could do an entire episode that's just on the horror of plastic surgery.
Yeah. Well, and body horror specifically, and why that appeals to so many people. And I think some of this, we really chose films that did not get into body horror, mm-hmm. specifically, because I think that there's a whole other can of worms to open with why we are so fascinated
or
and repulsed
by it.
Can of tentacles, maybe. Yeah. And also ageism, because we didn't really get to touch on it much. It is in The Neon Demon, this idea of ageism. And that really kind of fuels a lot of our fear over not being beautiful, is this idea of no longer being young. And I think we could talk about both of those things at length.
Yeah.
But we'll leave you here today.
Yes. I think this is a good stopping point for this. We've touched on, I think, the broad strokes of it.
Yeah.
We will get into some more minute stuff later, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we hope that you enjoyed this. And if you watch these films, please, I would love to hear what you thought of them and tell me how much you love them. Or, you know, if you don't like them, that's fine too. But really, they're all really good movies.
Yeah.
And if you know of any other ones that I think would be good to talk about in terms of beauty or ageism or body horror, let us know, because I'm always looking for new movies to watch. And there was a list that I really wanted to talk about and couldn't get to here. So yeah, give me more movies.
Yes. And as always, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, or you can now do that on Spotify as well. We would be very thankful for that. It helps us algorithmically.
It does.
And thank you.
Yes. And until next time, stay spooky.
Yeah. Let's go do some face mask or something.
All right.
Yeah, vampire facials. Culture Cryptids is recorded, produced, and engineered by me, JD.
And me, Corey. You can find us on social media at Culture Cryptids on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Questions, comments, corrections, hate mail? Email us at culturecryptids@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.